We turn now to the U.S.-Mexico border as Defense Secretary Jim Mattis travels to McAllen, Texas today to visit some of the thousands of troops deployed there by Trump. Nearly 6,000 active-duty troops are currently stationed in Texas, California, and Arizona following Trump's escalating attacks against the Central American caravan heading toward the U.S. in the run-up to the midterms. Trump has warned that the number could swell to 15,000, more than the U.S. forces in Afghanistan and almost triple the number of troops in Iraq. According to some reports, the border deployment could cost $220 million, despite the fact that the Pentagon does not see the caravan as a risk. A few hundred migrants from Central American caravans have arrived in the border town of Tijuana Tuesday, as the vast majority are still at least 1,000 miles away from the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mattis's visit comes just days after the Trump administration announced new immigration rules to deny asylum to anyone who enters the country outside of a port of entry, a move the American Civil Liberties Union calls illegal. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests here in New York. Fernanda Garcia is with us, the founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights, an advocacy group based in El Paso. And in far Texas, we're joined by Liz Castillo, immigration reporter, managing editor of NETA, a community news outlet in the Rio Grande Valley. She's been speaking with asylum seekers on the bridges and to the volunteers who are helping them. The lead up to the midterms, one action on the part of Trump after insult, whether he's introducing an order that would ban all immigrants coming into the country outside of a port of entry, or talking about the caravans as invasions or invaders. Can you talk about what's happening on the border?
Yes, thanks for having me. Yes. I mean, we had seen at the border, we are seeing everything that you can imagine in terms of this racist, anti-immigrant, not only rhetoric, but actually strategies and agendas of the president of the United States. I just came from Mexico. I actually went to have a discussion with our colleagues that are working with immigrant issues in the different NGOs. What I saw there was children, mothers and fathers and young people fleeing violence and persecution, fleeing poverty in Central America. So that doesn't match with what the president is talking about bad hombres, criminals, demonizing that caravan. There is not such a crisis of criminals coming to the border. The only crisis is the one that the president is creating by all of these things, because it's not only, I mean, how he's demonizing all of these refugees, but also is the construction of a border wall, the deployment of active duty soldiers, which actually setting up a very important precedent, probably even violating the Constitution of the United States and a very old provision that is called the Post Comitatus Act, that you cannot deploy the National Guard or the soldiers within the United States unless there's an emergency, a national emergency, or there is a war, and nothing like that is happening in our borders. So I think, obviously, this is a clear example of a distorted narrative being promoted by this president.
And Liz Castillo, I wanted to ask you, you've been interviewing migrants at the border. Could you talk about what you're finding, their perspective, their viewpoint on why they're coming?
The majority of the people, or everyone that we've been talking to, really has cited poverty, has cited threats of persecution, cited fear of safety in their country of origin, and that as a reason that they are coming here. And we've been talking to asylum seekers since mid-June, when the zero tolerance policy first started. And since then, we continue to witness an ongoing flow of people coming to the border, continuous groups. It started with smaller groups, but we're continuously viewing larger and larger groups. At this point, we never really see a group that's smaller than 20 people at any given bridge, but the average is usually far larger than that, and made up of families, made up of children, sometimes younger than a year old. We've seen people on the bridges who have medical conditions, including a teenager just this past month that had epileptic attacks on the bridge. And what we've seen is that whereas at the beginning of the summer, there were people who were only waiting there for maybe 3 or 4 days, which in of itself is a really hard and testing amount of time to be living on an international bridge, what we're seeing now is far larger waits, with people, no one that we're running into at this point is waiting less than 7 days. And we have some people telling us that they're waiting 2 weeks. We met some people who are saying that they have been waiting on the bridges for a month and more, particularly folks who are coming from African countries, which is something that my colleague Morgan Holmes has been closely following and reporting on.
And Fernando, the whole issue of why so many people are coming from Honduras. Most Americans are not paying attention to what's been happening in Honduras over the past few years. The United States government's involvement in supporting what's considered an illegitimate government government at this point there, and also the constant deportation from convicted felons who come out of prison, who are from Honduras, being sent back constantly to reinforce the gang violence there.
That is true. And sometimes we are reluctant, and I say as a society, to see what are the impacts and the effects of our U.S. policies in Central America and the rest of Latin America. As a matter of fact, I think there are two things that are very important to say in terms of the U.S. involvement. The first thing is the so-called trade agreements. I mean, even the one that they are negotiating with Mexico and the one that had negotiated with other countries, especially in Latin America, those trade agreements are not producing jobs, at least jobs where people can live with dignity, have housing, health care, better salaries. That is not happening in Central America. So there are reasons for people to leave because of those living conditions. The second thing that is very important is that there's this violence. Guess where they are getting the weapons from? From the United States. I mean, again, you have bad policies, bad economic policies. At the same time, most of the weapons where people is killing with in Central America are coming from the United States, and we actually are closing our eyes to actually discuss those issues. If we don't want immigrants to come, let's say for a minute that that's the goal, I think the United States would have a great opportunity to implement some kind of plan Marshall to elevate the living conditions in Central America, having a decent salary, decent housing, healthcare, so people would not have to come to the United States. But that is not happening. We are attacking this issue of immigration as an enforcement issue, or in the worst case, as a military issue. I mean, this is the ultimate scenario. This is the picture of America today. Soldiers at the border preparing to actually defend the country from children, from mothers, from immigrants, from refugees. I mean, how come we got to that point?
Liz Castillo, can you talk about military exercises on the border? I mean, there are now thousands of troops and thousands more U.S. troops that are being sent to the border. The cost, I think, is something like, now it's being estimated, something like $220 million.
Yeah, it's a shocking view for people who are from the Valley. We're watching people in full riot gear with their helmets, with their guns, and they seem to be conducting what can only be described as worst-case scenarios. And it seems completely out of touch with the actual people that we've met on the bridges, which, again, are women, are children, are elderly people. And so there's this real tangible fear that is coming from not just the drills and the exercises on the bridges and the messages that other law enforcement agencies are sending, including local agencies, which are saying things to the effect that they are ready with armored vehicles and that kind of thing, but also the effect that is cast upon people when they see military Humvees driving on the highway, or when they go to the Walmart or the local Sam's and there's also active duty troops and, again, full helmets and full gear shopping next to them. I think there's been a really dramatic increase in militarization within a really short span of time. We're talking about just within, you know, the last 2 weeks. And so there's a real fear in the air, and there's a tension, and there's a concern given just the history of Border Patrol, particularly this year, but also beyond this year, really, when it comes to disproportionate responses to things such as rock throwing, that it might not even take that, that it might not even take a rock for the first bullet to ring, just based on the tension and the message that is being sent and the way that law enforcement agencies seem to be preparing for what is a refugee caravan.
Liz, we just have a little bit of time left. What about the children that are still in U.S. custody, who were separated from their families, still 171 children, despite months-long judge's order to reunite them with their families?
I mean, I think it just speaks to this broader effect that is playing out at the border, also on the bridges, of a lack of a controlled and orderly process. I think that the Trump administration rule that was announced last Thursday is a great example of this sort of pattern of disorder and this willingness to ignore and to just pretend that there is order when there isn't. What we're seeing on the bridges is a process where people are taking 2 weeks, where people are taking a month, where some people are being lost track of, and there is no orderly process at the border. People cannot go to a port of asylum and go through an orderly process and hope to be processed within a week.
Struggle of a nation deep in the midst of globalization. Much frustration. frustration and humiliation. Poor people on the verge of annihilation. And in the quarters with the new world order, crops are replaced with maquiladoras. Hundreds of peasant señoras y señoras gotta make their way to the cities by the border. They arrive from the countryside, following the promise of a better life. But promises are made to be broken, while the authority figures are cloaking the truth with the rhetoric of progress. And it's all a big mess, being backed by the U.S. Damn, it makes me upset when all I read in the press is a little tiny blip. Say what?
Something going on at the border.
You keep on asking what, but you don't give a fuck.
Something's going on at the border.
You keep on asking what, but you don't give a fuck.
Something's going on at the border.
You keep on asking what, but you don't give a fuck.
Something's going on at the border.
Blow, baby, blow, blow, baby, blow, blow.
So, Brenda, it's been a year since the first Me Too Survivors March. A lot has happened this past year. What makes this year different from last year?
We're definitely making sure that there's a lot more space for the voices of survivors that are often overlooked, like our homeless, our trans community, our disabled community. I mean, there's a lot of voices that are being left behind, and I think that has changed in the year. A lot of survivors are starting to feel more comfortable to say, this is happening to me, and we're starting to see more accountability.
Just over a month ago, we had the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation, and many people saw that fight over his confirmation as a seminal moment for the Me Too movement, but he was confirmed in the end. Do you view that as a defeat for the movement?
I don't view it as a defeat. I see it as, you know, a bump in this fight. Definitely not a defeat. I think a defeat would have been not going out in the streets afterwards and saying we don't agree with this and we will make sure that our voices are heard and we will make sure that we are still saying we will keep these individuals accountable and we will do whatever we can to make sure that we don't forget that. It's definitely something that me to see happen, because that toxic masculinity, that patriarchy is still so embedded in our society. But we're definitely going to be here to, you know, smash that and like make sure that that's broken down.
We are here on the corner of Hollywood and Highland, in the heart of Hollywood, in one of the many places where rape culture is perpetuated and is deeply influential. But it's also one of the places where the Me Too movement has had a focus and a start, with some of Weinstein's accusers coming up. Is that why you chose this location for the march?
Yes. Well, last year when it did happen, we said, let's do it in Hollywood. Let's make sure that we let Hollywood know that, yes, this is happening in Hollywood, but it's happening in our communities as well. So we're going to be here making sure that they hear from the ones that are often overlooked. Toronto said it best. For every Harvey Weinstein, there's 100 of those in our communities. So that's what one of the reasons why we chose Hollywood, to make sure that those communities are here, letting Hollywood know, at least last year, this is happening to us too. It's not just Hollywood.
Yes, my name is Carla Estrada, and I am the founder of Antakya Travelers.
Why are you here today, Carla?
I am here to represent myself as a Me Too survivor and to tell my story that is very important, but also uplift the stories of those women that are still subjugated, they're still oppressed, and they are scared to come out with their personal stories of domestic abuse and sexual assault. Yes. It's as an immigrant myself, as an undocumented immigrant myself with DACA, I know that our demographic, it is more likely to get not only sexually assaulted but also raped, and it is less likely to report it to the authorities by the fact that we're not only minorities, we're not only women minorities, but also because we are undocumented. And there is the whole issue of ICE. So definitely that is something that we work with. And as an immigration paralegal, I do a lot of cases of UVs and BAWAs, which, by the way, are decreasing right now due to the attacks of the Trump administration towards those benefits for immigrants. Therefore, women nowadays in the supposed best country in the world are not only experiencing an attack on the legitimacy of their stories of sexual assault and domestic violence by the Trump administration, evidenced by the confirmation of Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court, but also immigrant women that not only have to deal with that, with sexual assault, domestic violence, sexual molestation, and an abuse of power, but also in attack in their immigration status. The Trump administration ordered USCIS that they can actually deny and give an NTA, which is a notice to appear, to processes such as the U visas and BAWAs. That means, like, where immigrant women, if they suffer sexual abuse, they go and may benefit, not a guarantee, that may benefit from immigration services through those programs. But those programs are being attacked. Therefore, that means that women are going to be like, why would I report this sexual assault, which is very, very traumatic? The whole process is traumatic. And I may even get deported because I was raped. And not only because it has not been reported, because the statistics have gone down, it does not mean it doesn't exist. It means that they are hiding because of the attacks that they've been going towards them. Women get raped in ICE facilities, not only by other inmates, but also the agents themselves. And nobody's talking about that. And not even in the Me Too movement.
About assaults against children.
Assaulting children. I am an immigration paralegal in criminal defense. And I've had cases on my organization and as an activist of women that have come up to me that are asylum seekers and tell me, during ICE detention, while I was like claiming legal asylum under international and national law, my kid was molested by an ICE agent. I told the ICE agent and they ignored me. They told me, why are you coming to my country if you did not want for that to happen to your kid? So we have all these stories that are never reported because people do not believe it, and people simply don't care. Where I'm here in a movement that was created by a black woman, Tarana Burke, and it has been co-opted a lot by white women. And they still don't talk about immigrant women that like they should. Great example, the caravan. Those women are fleeing persecution of domestic violence, sexual abuse by their partners more likely. And where is the Me Too movement in that? Why is the Me Too movement are going up to the border and saying, we're here for you women that are fleeing those persecutions? Because this is an epidemic, an international, a global epidemic. It's not only based in the United States. I've learned to live with it. And I've had the privilege to get services that can help me with my personal trauma, what happened to me in the past. However, those women do not. So I am here to not only represent myself and them, to give them a voice through me. And hopefully, all the organizers of the Me Too, like today, and the people that attended today, actually go down to TJ. The caravan is going to be here in 10 to 14 days in TJ. Therefore, I hope they go, and I hope they receive them with open arms to say, we're not only here to honor you as asylum seekers, legal asylum seekers, but also we're here in solidarity and support with the women of the caravan.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you very much for your attention.
My name is Hussein Turk, and I am a civil rights attorney, and I also work with survivors of sexual assault and sexual harassment. And I'm here because of the clients that I represent, and also because I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, sexual assault, and child pornography. It's more challenging for male victims to come forward in certain contexts because of the toxicity of masculinity that prevents us or tells us that we can't be weak, we can't be vulnerable, and we can't be victims.
So you see yourself as part of this movement that has started up a year ago and, of course, has built on the feminist movement from before?
I absolutely see myself as a part of this movement, not just because I'm a survivor, but also because as a man who has male privilege in a system that benefits from and depends on sexual violence against women and other marginalized people, I have an obligation to use the privilege and power that I have to create space and to enable other people to step up and talk about their experience and come together and heal. On two levels, I have to be here as a man and also as a survivor. I think it's very important for people to speak out if they have been victimized or survived sexual violence. I also think it's so important for us to be respectful of privacy and to recognize that not everyone has the space or the privilege or the resources or the access to speak up. Because a lot of folks who have been victimized will lose their jobs if they do speak up. And so we need to be recognizing also that there's power in speaking up, and then there's also very important reasons why people don't, and we need to create space for both. When I speak out, I know that it's raising awareness and it's letting other people know who have experienced something similar to me but don't have the ability or the resources to speak up, that they're not alone. Because one of the most, I think, harmful, injurious effects of sexual assault and violence is that we feel isolated and we feel alone. And so to know that there is someone else out there who has been through something that I've been through or similar to what I've been through, it brings me so much peace and serenity and just strength. It creates an opening for me to begin healing and recognizing that I'm not alone.
What does justice look like? What is this movement asking for in terms of something, you know, a real justice? I mean, we've had the court cases around Harvey Weinstein still going on, the Cosby trial after many years. That trial started before the Me Too movement, but that trial finally culminated. Does justice look like going through the justice system, or is it broader than that?
I think it's more than that. I've been through the justice system, and it didn't work for me. The justice system made me almost feel like I was the one that did something wrong. So I think definitely real justice would start in the courtroom, making sure that we are treating survivors with respect and more dignity, and making sure that we are saying, you did nothing wrong. This is them. They're the ones that need to be put on trial, not the survivor. I think real justice looks like actually not having to feel like you can go into your workplace and say, this is happening to me, because then you're going to feel like, oh, they're going to retaliate about me. Real justice has to be more than just a courtroom. It has to be in our workplaces and in our schools, in our church, in our, you know, sacred circles. It has to be more than just one place.
It has to be a cultural shift.
It has to be a cultural shift. We have to. I think the rape culture is very strong, and we have a lot to stop that and change that.
I don't think that the culture is changing fast enough. I think that unfortunately when survivors speak out in institutional spaces like in courts of law, their stories are still discredited and discounted, and there's re-traumatization that happens. I think that institutions like the legal institution need a very radical revolutionizing in the way that we seek remedies, in the way that we honor emotion, and the way that we really empower those who are speaking up. Because right now, when someone speaks up, they're still discredited, they're still mistrusted. You saw it with Kavanaugh. The abusers, the perpetrators, they still get into the spaces that they want to get into. And so I don't know if the culture is changing, but I do know that what is changing is the sense of community and the sense of wrongness that we are fostering here today. And that is a start.
The serial rapist, Officer Daniel Holtzclaw, in preying on his victims, he exclusively chose black women. And he told them, no one will believe you because you're black and I'm a cop. And so, you know, the national struggle and racism and bigotry demeaning people as disposable absolutely adds to the vulnerability. You have indigenous women that are raped, working women abroad who are being killed, you know, and preyed upon. So I definitely think that being nationally oppressed, it gives you a whole nother level of vulnerability, because we don't have white woman fragility to lean on, you know. And the white woman fragility was literally fashioned out of black bloodshed, with black people, thousands of black people lynched and townships burned down because it was an accusation of a white woman had been whistled at or raped. Emmett Till was brutally murdered, a child, because a white woman said that he whistled at her. So there's definitely some contradictions historically in rape culture, because the white woman has historically been used as a scapegoat to justify lynching black people. So, you know, I think that these contradictions need to be brought into light so that this movement can be real and there can be true camaraderie between women and oppressed people and survivors, so that we can sweep this and isolate those who project onto women and exploit people sexually.
Well, it sounds like the march has begun. Thank you so much for being here and for your voice.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Sonali. Love you.
I say, let us put man and woman together to find out which one is smarter. Some say men, but I say no. The women got the men beat, they should know, and not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, that's right. Ah, ever since the world began, woman was always teaching man. And if you listen to my bit attentively, I'm going to tell you how she smarter than he, and not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. Garden of Eden was very nice. Adam never worked in paradise. Eve meets snake, paradise gone. She make Adam work from that day on. And not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, that's right. Samson was the strongest man long ago. No one could have beat him, as we all know, until he loved Delilah. Lila said, all of the strength is in the hair of your head, and not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, that's right. Ah, you meet a girl at a ballroom dance, thinking that you would stand a chance. Take her home thinking she's alone. Open the door, you find her mama home. And not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. Oh yes, smarter.
Last week, I received a visit at my door from two FBI agents. who wanted to inform me that they had discovered in this man's van in Florida what they called a, quote, abundance of research on me, both on his computer and in his van. I think mostly they seemed confused as they wanted to know where the package bomb was to me because it had not arrived yet. So, because it appeared from their investigation that I was high on his list. You know, I couldn't help them because I'm fortunate enough to not have had that happen. But I've dealt with this for a couple of decades, really, of people either saying they were going to kill me or trying to kill me. You know, I've been assaulted a number of times on the street, speaking on the stage. And after I won the Oscar for Bowling for Columbine and gave that speech on the fourth night of the Iraq War.
We live in fictitious times. We live in the time where we have fictitious election results that elects a fictitious president. We live in a time where we have a man sending us to war for fictitious reasons, whether it's the fictition of duct tape or the fictitious of orange alerts. We are against this war, Mr. Bush. Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you. And anytime you've got the Pope and the Dixie Chicks against you, your time is up. Thank you very much.
A man built a fertilizer bomb, a la Oklahoma City, to blow up my house in Michigan. And he was cleaning his AK-47, and it accidentally went off, and a neighbor heard it, and the police came and arrested him. And in his diary, he found his hit list, and I was at the top of that list. After me, it was Janet Reno, Hillary Clinton, Rosie O'Donnell. And when the police told me this, my first thought was, how did I make the lesbian list? I mean, I was honored. Don't get me wrong. So, you know, I always look for the silver lining in these dark clouds. But same thing happened, too, when the day they arrested him. And he's got a picture of me on the side of his van in Florida. Literally, my first thought was, geez, he actually picked a really good picture of me because I don't really photograph that well. So, and the target, the gun sight, was not right over my face. It was kind of more over my neck and shoulder. And I thought, I consider that a concession on his part. So, you know, I'm fine. The only terrorist threat to me really is, I just heard that McDonald's was bringing back the McRib. So, that's all I have to worry about.
I understand you also found footage as you were, well, I don't think it happened while you were doing the film, but after this happened and his identity was known, then you found
footage. No, the very first shoot that we did last year, this was Trump's first rally for his reelection in 2020, 4 weeks after his inauguration. And so the idea was to go down there and film not Trump, because we all know what he has to say, film the people who are there. And so they trained their cameras on the mostly white, angry male audience. There he was right in the front row up metal barricades. Cesar Sayak, the man with the package bombs in the van. But that's kind of, you know this from working with us. We tend to show up at things. You know, we were following Alexandria around in the Bronx and Queens months before the election when she was polling at -3%. You know, we're always trying to pay attention to what's going on. And if we had a wider scope to our vision, and I mean that literally and symbolically, but I think we would see more of what's about to happen to us sooner. And I think what we need to be listening to and paying attention to is the stuff that's over there. And that's why for so many years, the culture, the society, the film industry has ignored women, has ignored LGBTQ people, has ignored people of color, has ignored young people, the people who really make up America. America is right now, I think, 68, 69% women, people of color, or young adults between the ages of 18 and 35. That's the vast majority of the, when you say America, you need to think that's what it is. It's not me. It's not the white guy who's still running it. It's the people who are in the peripheral vision. The people who have been kept out. And that is both the crime and the solution. That the crime being that they're kept over and out there. And the solution, they are the solution. And they, a goodly number of them on Tuesday, proved that they could do this. If there are people in here who went up knocking on doors for Antonio Delgado, that is a district, that is a rural district, New York 19, I believe, right? And they elected a black man to represent them. And I'm certain that there were people in the Democratic Party structure, the apparatus, the hacks that run the party that's kept us down kept us away from defeating the enemy all these years. I'm sure they did not want him to win the primary. I know for a fact. I know for you. Well, you heard Alexandria say 15 minutes after she dropped off her petitions there in the Bronx, the Democratic Party lawyers were in there trying to rip it apart and trying to make sure she didn't make it on the ballot. That's who the Democratic capital D, capital P party is. Not Democrats, not you know, people who vote for Democrats. I vote for Democrats. But I'm talking about this party structure that is going to try to tamp down the Alexandrias and the Rashidas as soon as they go into session on January 2nd. And it's our job to make sure that they are the ones leading the new Congress, not the old hacks who have compromised and sold us out for so long. Our real problem is going to be them. We already know what the problem with Trump is, and he's already spinning out of control. They have got to fight this. And then when you still have Nancy Pelosi saying, well, no, don't talk impeachment. You know, we don't have the Senate. We wouldn't win it anyways. That's crazy making. And she has made herself, to me at least, ineligible to be the House Speaker with her inability to really understand the moment we're in right now. And that moment has to be led by the Antonio Delgados, by the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes, and the Rashida Tlaibs.
I appreciated at the end of your film that you didn't just leave us with the impression that Trump is just a descendant of sort of fascists, but is a product of a mythology that is embraced about what America is, and that you're saying, I'm fighting for an America that hasn't yet existed. To what extent is Trump driving the agenda right now in all of the authoritarianism that you showcased here? And to what extent is this just how the Republican Party is, and this is their best shot they've had in generations to ram all of it through because Trump is delivering? He's like a Trojan horse for them.
Trump was always treated very poorly by the uber rich of New York City. Wall Street didn't like him. The big banks didn't like him. And he always felt slighted by them. They treated him as if he was like the trailer trash of millionaires from Queens. They'll talk like he was from Queens, you know, the whole thing. And they certainly were not that excited about him running. They immediately figured out how he could be a useful tool for them, for capitalism. And that's why not only has there not been a peep out of them since he gave them their tax cut and has done all the other things in terms of cutting EPA regulations and things that we don't even know about that happen on a daily basis in each federal government department, because you just could never keep up with it if you actually knew what was going on every day. 2 weeks ago, he got rid of the department at the EPA that's responsible for the environmental health of children, fired the woman, got rid of the people. That's it. Gone. Hardly anything on it in the news. You have no idea how many millions of acres of land he gave away today to the oil and gas companies. This happens every single day, and he is doing the work now of Wall Street and the big banks in corporate America, and they are the main beneficiaries of what he's doing to dismantle from inside the federal government. The Yale professor that's in the film at the end, Timothy Snyder, he said something to me. It's not in the film. Democracy does not have a self-correcting mechanism. It's not like the modern automobile that when your car goes into a skid now, the brakes, there's a self-correcting mechanism. It'll kind of steer you out of the skid. Democracy is a piece of paper, and it's always about whether how the people of that certain era decide to treat that piece of paper and either amend it, make it better, ignore it. And if someone is taking us on a skid to the precipice, it does not have a self-correcting mechanism other than we the people. And I've always felt, as I've gone through the years of making my films for these studios, for these network entities, that the only reason they allow me to keep making these movies, the only reason they give me the money to make these movies is because they make money off it for themselves. That's it. If people stop going, I would not get any money. But more important than the money is they are confident that if a million people have seen this film already, which is, I'm guessing, roughly how many have seen it, they are so confident that they have dumbed down or numbed down the population that no one is getting up after seeing this movie and starting the revolution. They're so confident we won't do that because they've made our lives so miserable because you're living from paycheck to paycheck. You've got to get that second job. You don't know if the kids are going to be able to get into college. They've got everybody so wound up. They can't pay for their parents' health bills. Everybody in here knows what I'm talking about because everybody's living it. And you've got to think of your family first. You got to take care of yourself first. And they've got everybody focused on that.
so that you can't get political. You can't do anything about it. And so they can let Michael Moore keep making his little movies because they know no one will do anything about it. And the game that's going on here is that I believe the opposite. I believe they made a bad bet on me. They're convinced that I'm good for business because they make money and nobody here will do anything. I'm convinced that one or 100 or 1,000 or 100,000 or those kids that I went down to see in Parkland a week or two after the shooting, man, oh man, that's what's really going on. And that's what they need to be afraid of, but they don't even know. They don't even know what's coming down the pike. The people are going to rise up. They already have. They don't see it because it's in the periphery, because they're transgender, because they're women, because they're not what they're used to. They don't look like Tom Friedman. They don't look like Nick Kristoff, you know? And to their detriment, they've made a bad bet on me because I keep doing this because I believe eventually the dam will break and somebody is going to lose their job when they find it. Who the f*** gave him the money to make that movie? Don't ever give him any money again. And that's when you'll see the last of me, which will be good because that will mean hundreds of thousands, millions will have risen up and done the job and I can go have a McRib and shut the fuck up.
Who would beat Trump? Who do you think should run? Because as it is, it's going to be Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren maybe is talking about it, Joe Biden. I mean, you know, the whole Chuck Todd talks about it all the time. But who would you like to see run? Who could beat him?
You mean the question implies other than me, right?
I'm including you in it and Oprah, but...
You know, I'd love to do it only because I would love to just do the debate. You know, that alone would be, you know, it would... Yes.
If you decide but not to run...
I'm not here for your entertainment pleasure.
Okay, got it.
Just to run against Trump.
Got it.
We have to run a beloved American. We have to win. So ask yourself as you process who this person is this person a beloved American? Who is a beloved American that has our politics? Beto O'Rourke, yes, I agree with that. Somebody who's not a politician. The American people wanted a bartender from the Bronx, not a politician. They wanted a Palestinian-American from Detroit, a single mom. Who is not a politician and a beloved American?
Oprah.
Obviously, Oprah. Everyone loves Oprah. And my deal with her would be we would give her show back at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, except it would come from the Oval Office. Tom Hanks. I've twice asked Tom Hanks to run. Who the hell doesn't like Tom Hanks? Come on. No. The guy, he's got great politics. He's a smart guy. Michelle Obama would win. Michelle Obama would win. She's to the left of her husband. She is beloved. I'm sure she doesn't want to get within 10 feet of the White House. Nonetheless, man, she's got the fire in her. She should be the template. If she doesn't run, it should be who's our Michelle Obama that could win. Why can't we start thinking like this? See, I'm watching people's faces. You can't see this on your podcast, but it's the look of, no, wait a minute. Why do we have to do a celebrity thing? We're the smarter party. We're the smarter people. You know, why does it have to be that? Because it's America. If you don't want to live here, you can go to other countries where you don't have to have a reality show to get into the White House. I can name those countries for you. But if you're going to friggin' stay here, we've got to win. If we get the right person in there, they can help bring us back to a more intellectual place. But first, we got to get in there and we've got to win. I can't name that person tonight as to who that is. And I love Elizabeth Warren and I love Kamala Harris and Corey seems like a good guy and all that. But I hear people say we can't run a woman. Why not? I think we have to run a woman. If possible, it should be a woman. Why? Because of Hillary? She won. We still don't know that we won. We still don't know that our side came out 3 million votes ahead, 10 million votes ahead in the Senate races on Tuesday. We'd have a much harder time if we were Martin Luther King in the 50s or Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan in the 60s. They had to actually convince people to stop thinking the way you thought for hundreds of years. We don't have to do that. We don't have to convince people to be pro-choice or that climate change is real or that the minimum wage is too low or that women should be paid the same as men. We don't have to do any convincing. That's the hard part. It's handed to us. The silver platter is called the American public. Why don't we use that? Why don't we start acting like the winners and the majority that we are? And let's run somebody who's going to win. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer by coming up with the magic person right now, and maybe it's too soon, but, you know, I will go out and I will work for that person and I'll do everything I can. What was the second part of your question?
On the day that your mentality decides to try to catch up with your biology, come round, 'cause I want the one I can't have, and it's driving me mad. It's all over, all over, all over my face. On the day that your mentality catches up with your biology, I want the one I can't have, and it's driving me mad. It's all over, all over, all over my face. A double bed and a stalwart lover for sure, these are the riches of the poor. A double bed and a stalwart lover for sure, these are the riches of the poor. And I want the one I can't have, and it's driving me mad. It's all over, all over, all over my face. A tough kid who sometimes swallows nails, raised on prisoner's aid. He killed a policeman when he was 13, and somehow that really impressed me. It's written all over my face. Oh, these are the riches of the poor. These are the riches of the poor. It's written all over my face. On the day that your mentality catches up with your biology, and if you ever need self-validation, then meet me in the alley by the railway station. It's all over.
Recent midterm elections offered an opportunity for America's moneyed elites to spend their ridiculous wealth on a catalog of their favorite causes and candidates. We're locked in a vicious cycle where billionaires continue to amass wealth due to policies their influence has bought, which in turn enrich them with even more resources with which to shift the American polity in their favor. Part of the problem is that billionaires' control over our democracy is largely invisible. As a recent study by The Guardian showed, high-profile wealthy elites like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates are anomalies. To that point, most of the wealthiest U.S. billionaires have made substantial financial contributions amounting to hundreds of thousands of reported dollars annually, in addition to any undisclosed dark money contributions to conservative Republican candidates and officials who favor the very unpopular step of cutting rather than expanding Social Security benefits, write the report's authors. Yet over the 10-year period we have studied, 97% of the wealthiest billionaires have said nothing at all about Social Security policy. The midterm races in California saw several examples of the insidious ways in which the billionaire class made its mark on democracy, most notably in the defeat of Proposition 10, the state ordinance that would have expanded local government's jurisdiction over rent control. Several years ago, Wall Street hedge fund managers began scooping up rental properties and foreclosed homes in LA. According to journalist David Dayan, hedge funds, private equity firms, and the biggest banks have raised massive amounts of capital to buy distressed or foreclosed single-family homes, often in bulk at bargain prices. He added, it's the next Wall Street gold rush, with all the warning signs of a renewed speculative bubble. So it should have come as no surprise that those same firms spent millions to protect their investments from returning lower profits in their fight against Prop 10. Sadly, Californians bought the corporate propaganda hook, line, and sinker and voted it down by a whopping 61.7%, saying no to rent control. Incidentally, the opposition to rent control was also bizarrely funded in part by the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association. Also in California, billionaires bankrolled the campaign of Marshall Tuck, a corporate candidate for school superintendent who strongly supports the privatization of schools. The race between Tuck and his union-backed rival Tony Thurmond broke records for the millions of dollars that the candidates raised and the tens of millions that flowed in from outside groups, a shocking trend considering the down-ballot status of the race in a critical midterm election year. Among the deep-pocketed individuals who backed Tuck were members of the Walton family, the CEO of Netflix, and Eli Broad, a wealthy philanthropist known for his pro-charter school agenda. If voters knew that billionaires were spending ridiculous amounts of money to elect a pro-privatization candidate, surely teachers and the parents of public school students might be inclined to view them with distrust? In San Francisco, voters cast ballots for a tax initiative called Proposition C, a progressive tax on large corporations aimed at funding initiatives for the homeless. But Prop C passed, likely because there were billionaires spending big on both sides of the campaign. The city has Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff to thank for deigning to do the right thing and pushing for the initiative in opposition to the likes of Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and others. Countless examples abound around this nation where billionaires have gotten what they wanted simply because they had limitless wealth to throw at their favorite causes. As voters, we need to become literate in the ways of the moneyed class when it comes to elections. It's very simple. Figure out who has poured millions into an issue or candidate and ask whether that person's agenda might be less than noble. It may be that once in a while, the values of ordinary Americans align with those of billionaires, but that's the exception rather than the rule. Wealthy people are swimming in riches because the rest of us are not. Their wealth is relative. They are the haves, we are the have-nots. And they clearly like having a lot more than us and are willing to spend some of their mountains of cash to ensure they remain ensconced in power. Throwing enormous amounts of money at a race doesn't always bear fruit. For example, the politically active billionaire Sheldon Adelson failed in his recent bid to stop a renewable energy initiative in Nevada. But these, mostly male magnates, are so wealthy that the calculus of their political influence is on a completely different scale than ours. They literally have money to burn. They could lose $100 million in a political fight and walk away still brazenly wealthier and more privileged than most of us could imagine being. Billionaires are not old Republicans. Were it so clear-cut, ordinary Americans could unite under the wing of the Democratic Party to beat back the GOP's billionaire agenda. But corporate greed is a bipartisan project. For example, J.B. Pritzker waltzed into the position of Illinois governor after running as a Democrat. He had so much money that he didn't need to raise funds for his candidacy. He simply used his own, an unimaginable amount of $171.5 million. Had he lost, he probably would have had plenty left over to spend on a future second, third, or fourth try until he won. His opponent, Republican incumbent Bruce Rauner, is also fantastically rich. Between the two candidates, Illinois voters were bombarded with a whopping $230 million worth of campaign spending. Imagine the badly needed projects that such money could have funded. Wealthy Americans are already benefiting hand over fist from the tax giveaway that their Republican proxies in Congress passed last year. According to the New York Times, the law didn't necessarily help the merely rich, but was a windfall for the ultra-rich. Because, as author Andrew Ross Sorkin noted, if you're a billionaire with your own company and are happy to use your private jet, so you can commute from a low-tax state, the plan is a godsend. You can make an assortment of end runs around the highest tax rates. The so-called pass-through tax deductions were written in expressly for the obscenely wealthy. It appears that for the greedy few, no amount of wealth hoarding is enough. Alongside election literacy, we voters need to develop a healthy sense of disdain, disgust, and revulsion toward the billionaire class. In matters of politics, they are literally the enemies of the people, to borrow a phrase from Trump.
Deny, deflect. That's the name of a new bombshell investigation by the New York Times, revealing that Facebook executives, including CEO Mark Zuckerberg and Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg, were aware of a Russian misinformation campaign on the social media network and took a series of extraordinary private actions to preserve Facebook's reputation, launching an aggressive lobbying campaign to combat critics and spread misinformation. The New York Times investigation reveals that Facebook hired the Republican opposition research firm Definers Public Affairs to discredit critics of Facebook, linking them to the billionaire liberal donor George Soros. Facebook also allegedly lobbied a Jewish civil rights group to condemn criticism of the company as anti-Semitic. Since the publication of the investigation, Facebook has announced it will cut ties with Definers. During Thursday's press call, Zuckerberg dismissed claims Facebook ignored Russia's election meddling or undermined investigations. Zuckerberg dodged questions about anyone being fired in light of the New York Times revelations. He said Facebook plans to institute an independent oversight board. Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, one of the organizations targeted by Definers Public Affairs, the PR company Facebook employed. And in Durham, New Hampshire, we're joined by Siva Vaidyanathan. His new article for Slate is headlined, Facebook is a Normal Sleazy Company Now. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Siva, let's begin with you. Can you summarize the New York Times investigation and what most surprised and concerned you about what it revealed about Facebook?
This Times investigation took more than 6 months. It required the work of more than five reporters and a team of researchers. It delved very deeply into former Facebook employees and current Facebook employees and their testimony about what went on inside the company. And just as importantly, in Washington, D.C., over the past 2 years. Now, over the past 2 years, we have had this barrage of revelations about Facebook. The big picture is Facebook is impossible to govern, impossible to control, and Facebook had explicitly encouraged, for instance, all of our personal data to go out to third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties like Cambridge Analytica. We can't even know where all this data went. That was one scandal. The other scandal is Facebook is beyond susceptible. Facebook amplifies all sorts of misinformation, propaganda, disinformation, much of which came from Russia trying to mess with American democracy, but a lot of it comes domestically too, comes from domestic hate groups, comes from political operatives who seem a bit more mainstream. Within all of this, right, Facebook, we know, has been scrambling to make sense of it, has been declaring itself innocent and ignorant for months and for years. Mark Zuckerberg has seemed stunned by this sort of cognitive dissonance that this thing he created that was supposed to unify the world and make us all treat each other better has turned out to do just the opposite. What the Times report showed is, first of all, that in fact, Mark Zuckerberg has been checked out for more than 2 years. He's just not on top of the daily operations. He has let other people handle the reactions to these revelations. And those other people include his chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg. But there's a whole team of people, including a number of lobbyists who either work directly for Facebook or have been contracted from Facebook. And they have been, and this is what's really mind-blowing, they have been distributing the same kinds of propaganda that have been undermining faith in American institutions and American democracy, the same kinds of propaganda that have been distracting us, the same kinds of propaganda that have generated violence in other parts of the world, the same kinds of propaganda that link critics to George Soros. Facebook has basically employed a company to engage in the very sorts of propaganda, anti-Semitic and otherwise, against its critics on the Hill, its critics in the public sector, its critics in the technology world, its competitors like Twitter and Google. It's really stunning that Facebook was so foolish and clueless. But I think more than that, it shows how desperate the leadership of Facebook is. So while Zuckerberg has been checked out, really doesn't know what's going on, Sandberg has been engaged in all sorts of nefarious machinations, leveraging her political and cultural capital, which is substantial, right? She is one of the most connected people in American corporate life, having worked in the Treasury Department of the Clinton administration, having worked for Larry Summers, having worked at Google, having written several best-selling books, you know, being friends with every major media figure in America. She has tremendous pull. The person she has most pull with, it seems, is Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, the most powerful Democrat in the Senate. The second revelation that was really shocking was that Chuck Schumer approached my senator, Mark Warner, and said, you need to back off of Facebook. Facebook is a friend of the Democrats. Sandberg's a friend of the Democrats. You need to go easy on it. Now, fortunately, my senator cares more about the fate of the Republic than he does campaign donations from Facebook, which he wasn't likely to get anyway. So he he's been able to make a stand and ignore Schumer. Not every senator is willing to do that, but I think we can safely assume that because of Schumer's implications, Schumer's connections with Facebook, his dependence on Facebook, and the fact that Schumer's daughter works for Facebook, we probably can't count on reasonable legislation, regulation coming out of the U.S. Senate anytime soon.
Well, Rashad Robinson, you're president of Color of Change. Talk about how your group fits into this picture. Your response to the news that Facebook hired a PR firm trying to discredit its critics, the group you were part of.
The New York Times story does have some inaccuracies. It links us to this group, Freedom from Facebook, which Color of Change isn't and has never been a member of, although, you know, we do know some of the work that they're doing. For the last several years, Color of Change, as an independent black political civil rights organization, has pushed Facebook around a wide range of violations. Everything from the way that race was weaponized on their platform during the 2016 election, Facebook pages and groups were created to drum up hate, to the ways in which certain practices on their platform circumvent civil rights law. You can use algorithms to market housing to certain communities and cut certain communities out of it, sort of avoiding public accountability. Accommodation laws. There's ways in which some of the issues around safety and attacks and hate language targeted at black activists has not been dealt with. We called for and led a campaign to demand Facebook implement a civil rights audit of all of their policies and practices. And we actually won that campaign. Facebook agreed. And over the last several months, we've been in deep conversation back and forth as they've pursued this civil rights audit. And to like be sitting across the table with Facebook, be pushing them around everything from sort of how they think about the election and voting rights and how voter suppression could be drummed up on their platform to racial justice issues on their platform and hate speech. To have all of that sort of happen while at the same time they hired a firm that really sort of put out this anti-Semitic and anti-black narrative, the anti-Semitic sort of narrative that this Jewish billionaire controls the world, that Jews control the world, is deeply troublesome. It has deep historical challenges, but it also seeks to undermine social movements. The idea that it's a black civil rights organization founded in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when black people were literally on their roofs demanding the government do something, and two black leaders came together to build Color of Change, a force to channel the presence that black people have in the world into the power to make real change, that our victories, our strategies, our vision for how we fight for liberation for black people is somehow controlled by some white liberal billionaire who decides to give us some money and that we don't have our own ideas, is deeply troubling and deeply anti-black. The fact of the matter is George Soros is not our biggest donor. He's not even one of our top five biggest donors. And if George Soros wanted to be our biggest donor and give us a lot more money to fight the causes that we fight every day, we would take that money. We don't, as an organization, racially profile or profile by religion our donors. We do not accept money from corporations. We do not accept money from government. And what we do every single day is try to work to build power and change the rules that hold black people back. And so to be in this conversation right now is deeply troubling. To have Facebook deploy these tactics, which are being deployed around the world, especially in this moment where we've seen such an uptick in anti-Semitic hate, an uptick in anti-black hate, seeing the consequences of that in really stark ways with deep violence happening to communities, that Facebook would do that and has yet to apologize for the hiring of this firm, for these tactics it deploys. At the end of the day, though, Facebook is an incredibly powerful platform, the most powerful communication platform in the world. And we recognize as a civil rights organization that sits across the table from Facebook and refuses to take money from them, we recognize that we have to do the work to hold them accountable. That's part of what we have to do to move independence. And it's just going to be harder over these next couple of months, recognizing that these are some of the tactics that they're willing to deploy. The final thing I'll say about this is we've noticed an uptick over the last several months of people, of journalists asking us if we had money from George Soros, if George Soros had donated to us. We've noticed an uptick in attacks on our website personal threats against me as the leader, where, you know, we've had to, you know, hire and engage a security expert. This has real consequences for the safety, for the well-being, for our ability to express our will for a better future. You may disagree with our tactics, but to attack us and make us unsafe simply because we are trying to push you on a set of civil rights issues is shameful. We hope that Facebook addresses this. We've put out a set of demands for them, and there's really work that has to be done now to not just repair the relationship, but to move us forward with the concrete changes that have to be made.
What do you know about Definers Public Affairs, this Republican lobbying firm in Washington?
We don't know a lot about them. You know, they are a firm that says that they are made up of a whole set of, you know, veterans from Republican campaigns. You know, one could imagine the way that we saw certain tactics deployed in this last election. You know, we saw the new minority leader for the House of Representatives, McCarthy, tweet out shortly before the election that we can't have our election brought by George Soros, Michael Bloomberg, and Tom Steyer, you know, mentioning three Jewish donors. He actually pulled that tweet down after the Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh was shot up by the terrorist actions and pulled that down because it was very clear that that type of narrative about Jewish folks controlling and dictating the terms at which people raise their voices, make their voices heard in our democracy, fight for a better future, is this old trope. And the fact that they would take it down, recognize that they knew they had a problem. But we've seen these tactics deployed across the right wing. And to see that an organization that occupies such a mainstream space sort of move to these type of tactics also shows the ways in which these larger sort of strategies of Trump in this era have become mainstream. What was once on the margins is mainstream. We at Color of Change have had to actually work to force credit card companies to stop processing fees on white nationalist sites, had to go site by site looking at sites for folks like Richard Spencer. And you could go on that site and you could put your credit card number in, or you could put your PayPal number in. And we spent, you know, literally a year going back and forth with these companies. And after Charlottesville, the companies that were once upon a time telling us we had to go talk to the banks, and then the banks telling us we had to go talk to the credit card companies, we actually started to get them to make some headway. And about 40 sites no longer are allowed to process funds from like Visa, MasterCard, American Express. And some of those sites and some of those organizations have claimed they've shut their doors as a result of us cutting off their money. We are very familiar at Color of Change of being sort of in the middle of trying to hold accountable the enablers of white supremacy, the enablers of white nationalism, and preventing mainstream forces from being able to allow these institutions to grow and flourish and raise money. And so the New York Times story for us is really important, and it just speaks to the importance of investigative journalism, the importance of independent journalism, the importance that we have in this country of having a free press that will dig in, and all the ways in which even Facebook creates challenges to our ability to get sort of the information that we need to be good citizens in our democracy.
Siva Vaidyanathan, what do you make of Zuckerberg saying Facebook plans to institute an independent oversight board?
Great. 5 years too late. I mean, these problems have been building for 5 years. They've known about many of these problems for longer. Social media scholars like myself have been tracking many of these problems since at least 2011. Facebook has never taken it seriously. We know now from the Times article that Facebook's put a tremendous amount of energy into distracting us and confusing us and flooding the media ecosystem with more propaganda to get us all messed up about what's really happening. So, yeah, an independent review board. I mean, it'll probably be as effective as the independent review board that was supposed to clean up Uber. I mean, look, the fact is Facebook can't fix itself. It's too big. 2.2 billion people post things to it regularly in more than 100 languages. If you're going to host 2.2 billion people, a good number of them are going to mean to do harm to other people, right? Because we don't have that many great people in the world. So what is Facebook going to do about that? Well, it can't. It's too big. It can't filter. It can't edit. It just can't deal. That's one of the problems. Then you have its algorithms, which are explicitly designed to amplify things that generate strong emotions, like hate speech, like calls to genocide, like conspiracy theories, right? And if you argue with any of that stuff, if you go on Facebook and you see something like wacky telling you that like vaccinations cause autism or something, and you argue back and you say, oh, that's wrong, it's going to hurt children that you're spreading this news, and here are some real scientific sites, the very act of arguing with crazy stuff on Facebook amplifies it, makes it go farther. You can't argue with the crazy on Facebook. It is an upside down world. So the scale of it, 2.2 billion people in 100 languages, the algorithmic amplification, and the fact that it has this powerful advertising system that can target and put messages, all kinds of coercive messages or powerful messages in front of just the right people, just the susceptible people, whether that is selling shoes, selling tires, selling political candidates, or selling bigotry, it is so powerful. And everybody who is launching a nationalist movement, a bigoted movement, a hate movement, or an authoritarian movement knows it. You could not invent a better propaganda machine for that process than Facebook itself. There is no way to fix Facebook. There is no way to fix it internally without completely undermining everything that it is, because the problem with Facebook is Facebook.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
Caminos sin fronteras, flotar y flotar, volar y volar.
I hope everybody has big plans for the weekend. Donald Trump does. He's going to Paris. Or, as Trump describes it,
Paris is no longer Paris.
You're no longer Paris. By the power vested in me by no one, I hereby rename you Furry Armpit Junction.
Trump is in, he's over there. He's over there because he wants that military parade, right? He's over there for a big military parade that will mark the 100th anniversary of the ending of World War I in the armistice. In honor of America's service in the Great War, we are sending our biggest doughboy. It might be tense over there, but Trump will have at least one ally in Paris, Russian President Vladimir Putin. But when asked if he was going to meet with Putin while in Paris, Trump told reporters, "Probably not," explaining, "We haven't set anything up yet. Whatever happens, happens. We don't want to make the event too formal. The dress code is collusion casual."
The president was in Paris over the weekend to mark the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I. His KGB FF, Vladimir Putin, was there. Once again, Trump was very chummy with Putin. This was his face when his sugar Vladdy showed up. Look at that smile. Vladimir Putin comes in. He's cocky. He walks. Quick hello to Merkel, Macron. And now he gets to Trump, and who actually, again, is bites on his lip. He's so excited to see him. And then... and then things get so hot, I guess, on the inside. Yeah. Much was made of the fact that the president skipped the World War I memorial on Saturday because of weather.
These soldiers fought tirelessly through brutal conditions. So, of course, Trump canceled his trip to the cemetery due to rain.
White House claims Marine One, the president's chopper, was unable to take off because of rain. Basically, they said our country's most sophisticated helicopter has the same weakness as an Amazon package you leave on your porch. And while he could have driven by car to the event, he said he didn't want to cause a traffic jam. He's very considerate that way. Bottom line, he missed the memorial because he didn't want his hair to get wet.
Trump did attend the ceremonies yesterday, but the other leaders said mean things, like French President Emmanuel Macron.
Patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism by saying, our interests first, who cares about the others? We erase what a nation holds dearest, what gives it life, what makes it great. And what is essential, its moral values.
I just want to point out that a man gave a speech about the importance of moral values, and everyone assumes he was insulting our president. But Trump did have one ally. Unfortunately, it was not an ally. It was Vladimir Putin. Just look at Trump's face when Putin arrived. So happy. I can just imagine their inner monologues.
I am looking into the eyes of a sociopath. Mein Gott, this monster will kill us all. More than a feeling, more than a fear. When I see Vladimir walk my way.
The president sat out the weather at the American ambassador's residence in Paris, while his chief of staff, John Kelly, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff honored those fallen Americans. President Trump's failure to show up prompted widespread ridicule, from Winston Churchill's grandson calling it pathetic and inadequate, to the French army tweeting that rain is their Monday motivation. The American president had other opportunities, like the solemn stroll of world leaders to the Arc de Triomphe on Sunday, a procession that he missed. He showed up to the ceremony separately. And then there was the event at another American cemetery in the suburbs of Paris, where he made snarky comments about the weather while welcoming veterans and honored guests.
Frank DeVita. Thank you, Frank. Thank you very much. You look so comfortable up there under shelter as we're getting drenched. You're very smart people.
Doesn't like the rain. President returned to the United States, and today, when Veterans Day is observed, a day when presidents traditionally visit Arlington National Cemetery to pay respects on behalf of the nation, President Trump, who had literally nothing on his official public schedule, decided to stay at home and tweet about stopping the vote in Florida instead.
This man started this election by denigrating the service of John McCain and other POWs. We see what he's doing with our troops at the border, essentially using them as props. He attacked a Gold Star family. The president likes to use the troops for his political gain, but when it comes to personal sacrifice or any type of effort on his part, he won't go that extra mile.
I know it's hard to keep an open heart when even friends seem out to harm you. But if you can heal a broken heart, wouldn't time be out to charm you?
To the people of California, our thoughts are with you, because the Golden State is being ravaged by three deadly wildfires in Malibu and Northern California. There's been a tragic loss of life and an unprecedented loss of property. And at a time like this, it is hard to know the right thing to say. But for the wrong thing to say, let's check the president's Twitter feed.
There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California, except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year, with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments.
I think that's called blaming the victim. When Trump goes off the deep end, at least we can count on a response from reasonable experts like Guns N' Roses founder Axl Rose, who tweeted, actually, it's a lack of federal funding that's at the root of the purported forest mismanagement. Only a demented, truly pathetic individual would twist that around, use a tragedy to once again misrepresent facts for attempted public political gain at others' expense.
The wind whispered through the forest, a storm is coming. You cannot defeat the storm. From the trees rose a resounding voice, I fear nothing. I come when the trumpet sounds. I am the storm, the great American grizzly. Introducing the original Trumpy Bear, the fearless, super plush American grizzly. Trumpy Bear was born June 14th, Flag Day.
God bless America and God bless Trumpy Bear.
I love you, Trumpy Bear.
I was torn away from my mom at the border. But that's okay, I have my Trumpy Bear. Trumpy Bear, you're my new mom.
I get pulled over at least once a day for no good reason. But now I can make the police smile at my partner, Trumpy Bear.
I f***ed Trumpy Bear, and he paid me $2,000 to keep quiet. Thanks, Trumpy Bear.
Trumpy Bear isn't just a bear. He's a whole lot more. Find the secret zipper and pull out the cozy American flag-themed blanket. Keep digging and there are more treasures to be found, like this framed photo of Vladimir Putin, a half-eaten cheeseburger, Trumpy Bear tanning goggles, a six-piece KFC meal, a dead baby duck, and best of all, a fully loaded assault rifle. Order the super plush Trumpy Bear now for only two payments of $19.95. Don't miss out on owning a piece of American history that was made in China. Order in the next 5 minutes and receive a free Kellyanne Kitty. Every time she opens her meowth, lies pour out.
Fake news.
Trumpy Bear and Kellyanne Kitty are highly flammable, racist, and are not for anyone over or under the age of 12.
The mounting reports about discontent and disruption with the Times reports President Trump, stung by a rebuke in the midterms and nervous about the Mueller investigation, is retreating from traditional presidential duties. A source outside the White House who has spoken recently with the president said Friday's Wall Street Journal report confirming his central role in quietly arranging payoffs for two women alleging affairs with him seemed to put Trump in an even worse mood. The Washington Post dives deep into the past 5 days of fury, with the president's temper boiling over. Shortly after the president snapped at a reporter for what he called a stupid question about the Russia probe, he reportedly also snapped at America's closest ally. Sources tell the Post that aboard Air Force One, Trump again lost his cool during a phone call with British Prime Minister Theresa May, who called to congratulate him on the midterms. Trump reportedly berated May on Iran, trade, and Brexit, among other topics. On his flight to Paris and throughout the weekend, Trump was preoccupied by political developments. He watched TV with rapt attention as late counting votes resulted in the Senate race in Arizona and a number of House contests to slip out of Republican hands. And after he chose not to attend a memorial for American soldiers due to a lengthy motorcade, Trump told aides he thought he looked terrible and blamed his chief of staff's office for not counseling him that skipping the cemetery visit would be a public relations nightmare.
But then he comes, Willie, back to the United States, doesn't take a two-minute drive to Arlington to do what every president has done since JFK. And by the way, with all due respect to the congressman, this isn't an us weekly moment. It is one of the most sacred things a president does.
Yes.
Veterans Day and Memorial Day, one of the most sacred things that a president does. Does this White House emotional meltdown seem different than the others, or is this just one in the latest of, you know, 12, 13 times we've told this story?
Well, I think you have the intensity, as Mika sort of laid out there, of all these things coming at him at once. The midterm elections looking much worse than they even did on election night now, 8 or 9 days after the fact. You have that Wall Street Journal piece that goes into great detail with deep reporting about how the Trump campaign arranged for payoffs to women in the days leading up to Election Day. And I'll add to the mix this morning our NBC reporting from Ken Delanian and Hallie Jackson, that the president and his legal team, as we speak, are going through answers to the written questions submitted by the special counsel's office. That means the president is now confronted by what Bob Mueller has on him, confronted by the questions to which Bob Mueller wants answers. And, as a lot of experts have pointed out, the written answers are a prelude to an interview. So President Trump puts all this together, and you can see why he may be feeling isolated and embattled in that White House this morning.
The report that Mueller is going to ultimately give to Congress is going to be like a bombshell going off.
The special counsel stays active.
I actually have communicated with Assange.
As Democrats go after Trump's acting attorney general.
We are demanding that Mr. Whitaker recuse himself from the Russia investigation.
Stupid Watergate. Because on Wednesday, Trump did the thing that we've all kind of been bracing for.
Jeff Sessions, until last night, Donald Trump's attorney general and punchbag. After months of public abuse, the president finally moved from ridiculing his senior law officer to firing him.
It's true. Trump finally fired Jeff Sessions, and everyone in America has been waiting for this particular shoe to drop. Trump immediately appointed as acting AG, Sessions' former chief of staff, and everything about that appointment is weird. Starting with the fact that Sessions' natural successor would be Rod Rosenstein, but Trump is famously not a fan of him, as he's been protecting the Mueller investigation. So instead, Trump shoved White Shrek here into the job. And that is troubling for any number of reasons, from the fact that he's been a regular critic of the Mueller investigation, to his questionable judicial philosophy, both criticizing Marbury versus Madison, a bedrock Supreme Court decision, and suggesting that the key criterion for judges is, do they have a biblical view of justice? But I would argue that the biggest red flag is that Trump wants a toady who will restrain Mueller, and Whitaker appears to be that guy. Yet, the White House was amazingly reportedly surprised by the criticism of Whitaker and thinks it could jeopardize his chances of remaining in the post. But how is Trump going to distance himself from Whitaker? He made him acting attorney general. He met him in the Oval Office more than a dozen times. He went on Fox News and said, Matt Whitaker's a great guy. I mean, I know Matt Whitaker. But by Friday morning, Trump was already desperately backpedaling.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
I didn't know Matt Whitaker.
I know Matt Whitaker.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
I didn't know Matt Whitaker.
I know Matt Whitaker.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
I didn't know Matt Whitaker.
I know Matt Whitaker.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
I didn't know Matt Whitaker.
I know Matt Whitaker.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
When a gold diamond circle, when it fly high like a bird.
Less than 4 years ago, Mr. Whitaker was selling hot tub designs for a company that is being investigated as a scam con artist company. That's who we've got as acting attorney general of the United States. So that leaves us to one conclusion, that he's got a mandate and a mission that goes on beyond his legal qualifications to do the job. And that mission is to impact, for the benefit of the president, the Russian investigation, the special counsel investigation.
Donald Trump's war on the rule of law and his attempts to weaken and undermine the independence of the Justice Department. Their concerns joining the chorus of uproar over Trump's decision to put an outspoken critic of special counsel Robert Mueller in charge of his investigation. The attacks from within the president's own party come as Mueller appears to be intensifying his pursuit of the truth as it pertains to presidential trickster Roger Stone. The Wall Street Journal this afternoon reporting, quote, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office is exploring whether longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone tried to intimidate and discredit a witness who is contradicting Mr. Stone's version of events about his contacts with WikiLeaks, according to people who have spoken to Mueller's investigators. In grand jury sessions and interviews, prosecutors have repeatedly asked about emails, text messages, and online posts involving Mr. Stone and his former friend, New York radio personality Randy Credico. Mr. Stone has asserted that Credico was his back channel to WikiLeaks. And in terms of why this is potentially such an explosive development in the collusion investigation, the Wall Street Journal offers this. Quote, Mr. Mueller's team is examining whether Mr. Stone, along with several other pro-Trump activists, knew in advance about WikiLeaks' release of Democrats' emails in the 2016 campaign. At the heart of Mr. Mueller's inquiry is the question of whether anyone in Mr. Trump's orbit participated in Russia's efforts to hack and release the materials.
What is Roger Stone doing, to your mind, watching his behavior, the interviews, sort of selectively leaking different, you know, messages, changing his story? What's he doing?
I think he knows he's in trouble. He knows he's a key target of this investigation. I think he knows he's going to be indicted. He's definitely going to be one of the people. He's already been named by virtue of his messages in the indictment of the 13 Russians. Roger Stone is a little bit crazy. I mean, probably
like a fox.
Lot. Yeah, right, exactly. And so, I mean, this is more of a PR thing because Roger Stone is directly connected to only one person in this entire thing, and that is Donald Trump. He's the one that basically talked Trump into running for president, has been friendly with him in New York over the years. He put up this big charade of being fired from the Trump campaign so he could go undercover and do all of these things that he does in a campaign. He is out
so you
there.
Think he's a direct connection? That's the key to me.
He is.
Jill, here's where I see this going. there's going to be an effort if, in fact, Stone is indicted. And again, that is what he expects. Jerome Corsi also expects it. There's lots of evidence that suggests that. There's going to be this effort to say, Donald Trump barely knew the guy. Do you anticipate that? Is that a similar play that was used back in the Watergate days?
It's not so much that it was used in the Watergate days as that it's a traditional pattern for Donald Trump. I know him well until they get indicted. I never met him. Right. That's his pattern. He does it every time. He said it about every single person. Whitaker, he knew until he didn't know him. And so we can expect Donald Trump to say that very much.
I didn't know Matt Whitaker.
I mean, I know Matt Whitaker.
I don't know Matt Whitaker.
But I can tell you, Matt Whitaker's a great guy.
The Justice Department has inadvertently revealed it has prepared an indictment against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. In an unusual development, language about the charges against Assange were copied and pasted into an unrelated court filing that was recently unsealed. In the document, Assistant U.S. Attorney Kellen Dwyer wrote, "Due to the sophistication of the defendant and the publicity surrounding the case, no other procedure is likely to keep confidential the fact that Assange has been charged," unquote. The news broke Thursday night, just hours after the Wall Street Journal reported the Justice Department was planning to prosecute Assange. Julian Assange has been living since 2012 in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he has sought refuge and political asylum. It's unclear what charges may be brought against Assange. The Justice Department has previously considered prosecuting him over his role in the release of hacked DNC emails during the 2016 presidential campaign, as well as over the release of the so-called Iraq and Afghanistan war logs shared by U.S. military whistleblower Chelsea Manning. The Assange case has been closely followed by advocates for press freedom. Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch tweeted, "Deeply troubling if the Trump administration, which has shown little from a government official and publishing classified information, exactly what journalists do all the time." We go now to London, where we're joined by human rights attorney Jennifer Robinson. She's been advising Julian Assange and WikiLeaks since 2010. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jen Robinson. Can you talk about this inadvertent revealing of the intent to arrest Julian Assange?
This is confirmation of what we've been concerned about and been talking about since 2010. It is the reason, of course, that Julian Assange sought asylum and granted asylum inside the Ecuadorian embassy, and the reason he remains there today. This confirms what we've been saying, that there is a very real risk that the United States is going to seek to prosecute him for his publishing activities and potentially seek to extradite him, and that if there was to be an indictment, it would be sealed, it would be secret, and we wouldn't know that it existed until such time as he was in custody. This is precisely what we've learnt from the inadvertent disclosure from the U.S. Department of Justice overnight, and it confirms the concerns we've had and the reason why he was granted asylum in the first place.
Can you talk about his reaction? Have you spoken to him inside the Ecuadorian embassy right now?
I haven't yet been able to speak to him personally. I'm going into the embassy shortly to discuss it with him. But of course, we are concerned. There have been rumors over the past few weeks about what might happen. But of course, we must remember that this disclosure came from the Eastern District of Virginia. This is a criminal investigation that was started in 2010 in relation to disclosures made by WikiLeaks and the New York Times and the Guardian and other major newspapers around the world, which revealed evidence of U.S. war crimes, evidence that the United States had not been honest with the American public about how many civilians have been killed in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. These are important public interest disclosures, and that a publisher could face prosecution in the United States, and we now have confirmation that they've sought an indictment, over publishing such truthful public interest information is a real concern. And this is a concern not just for us and not just for Julian Assange, which is what we'll be discussing later today, but is also a concern for all of the press, all of the domestic press in the United States, but also what it says about what the United States is doing in terms of exercising jurisdiction over publishers all over the world. What does this mean? Does this mean that the U.S. could seek to prosecute a publisher who's publishing information from abroad about the United States? Will Russia, will Saudi Arabia, will China start to follow suit? So I think this raises questions not just for Julian Assange, but for journalists and publishers inside the United States and journalists and publishers everywhere who are publishing material about other states around the world.
I want to reread the tweet from Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch, who said, "Deeply troubling if the Trump administration, which has shown little regard for media freedom, would charge Assange challenge for receiving from a government official and publishing classified information, exactly what journalists do all the time. Jen Robinson.
I couldn't agree with Mr. Roth anymore. As we have said since 2010, a criminal investigation into WikiLeaks sets a dangerous precedent for all of the media. This is precisely what New York Times General Counsel David McCraw has been saying for many years, that he doesn't see how the US government can distinguish between what WikiLeaks does and what the New York Times does. Now, this criminal investigation was started under the Obama administration, but as we warned back then, this is a precedent that was dangerous. And now we have Trump, who has called the press the enemy of the people, who has been openly hostile towards the New York Times and other mainstream media organizations. And I think everyone ought to be concerned about what this potential indictment means. Of course, we are concerned. It is why Julian Assange sought asylum. It is why he remains inside the Ecuadorian embassy. But this has implications for all media in the US and, as I said, elsewhere around the world.
I want to turn to former NSA and CIA Director Michael Hayden. He appeared on CNN this morning.
And then fast forward to actually sending an agent of WikiLeaks to Hong Kong to assist Edward Snowden in the flight from U.S. justice. You then later have the release of cyber hacking tools apparently stolen from the United States government. And I'm not even up to the question of the American election in 2016 yet. I think there's a reason why he stayed in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for so long.
He went on to talk about comparing him to a journalist. He was speaking to John Berman, saying, because journalists curate information. But he started by talking about helping Edward Snowden leave Hong Kong. Talk about Julian Assange's history and Hayden saying these are the reasons he should be arrested, even outside of whatever the Mueller inquiry is about.
Well, let's take those two questions separately. We have the fact that WikiLeaks assisted Snowden in gaining asylum, and we have the fact that WikiLeaks has published CIA materials. Now, in respect to the CIA materials, WikiLeaks has done what other media organizations can and shouldn't do all the time, which is receiving classified information and publishing it in the public interest. That information was verified. It has been shown to be in the public interest, and WikiLeaks has done no different than any other media organization in publishing that material. With respect to assisting Edward Snowden, he has been granted asylum, and the disclosures made by Edward Snowden have been demonstrated to have been in the public interest. We've seen decisions on Americans' constitutional right to privacy showing that the conduct of the American government was unconstitutional. That is important public interest information. And I think the world has seen and been grateful for the publications that Edward Snowden has made, that he is now protected from extradition and prosecution for having made those disclosures is important, and WikiLeaks is to be thanked for that. Now, should someone face prosecution for having assisted a whistleblower, for having published information in the public interest? I think Americans ought to be asking themselves those questions. What does it mean for American democracy?
Let me go to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Last year, just after he became CIA director, in Pompeo's first major address, he blasted WikiLeaks.
It's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it really is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors like Russia. In reality, they champion nothing but their own celebrity. Their currency is clickbait, their moral compass non-existent, their mission, personal self-aggrandizement through destruction of Western values.
So that was Pompeo. Of course, this certainly went against what Trump had said. I believe in the campaign in a month or two, he praised WikiLeaks well over 100 times. Let's go to one of those moments.
This just came out. WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks.
There you go. Jennifer Robinson, if you could talk about Pompeo and Trump.
Well, Pompeo's statements as the head of the CIA demonstrate the fervor within the CIA and certainly to be seeking WikiLeaks prosecution. But to say that receiving and publishing information in the public interest is an attack on Western values is frankly wrong and a dangerous statement to be coming from the head of the CIA and someone who's been very senior in the Trump administration. This cuts at the heart of constitutional protections for free speech. It is protected under the US Constitution to receive and publish information that's in the public interest, even classified information, and that any publisher, including WikiLeaks, could be called a hostile non-state intelligence agency when media organizations around the world all the time, including the New York Times, including the Washington Post, receive classified information and publish it when it's in the public interest. To say that that is an attack on Western values is a very dangerous statement from the head of the CIA that ought to be investigated. Speaking to Trump's statements during the election, I think it's important to note that WikiLeaks has been doing the same thing that it's always been doing, which is, again, again, receiving and publishing information in the public interest. If we look back to 2010, when WikiLeaks was publishing material, the Cablegate material, the diplomatic cables, the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, demonstrating human rights abuse and corruption by the American government around the world, at that time, WikiLeaks was lauded by the progressive left-wing press and indeed by the liberal establishment. On Fox News, people like Sarah Palin were calling for him to be killed by drone strike. Fast forward many years later, and you see that the politics of any publication cuts in different ways, but the principle of what they do remains the same, which is to publish information which they verify to be correct and be in the public interest. That's what WikiLeaks does, and that the United States government is now taking such an aggressive approach towards prosecuting and extraditing a publisher for doing precisely that raises serious concerns about U.S. press freedom for all publishers and all journalists in the United States.
Jen, I wanted to ask you about the Mueller inquiry, and I wanted to turn to a moment on Democracy Now! When we had journalist Alan Narinon debating Julian Assange on Democracy Now!
I have a brief question for Julian Assange. Mr. Assange, you said that you did not get the leaks directly from a state. You said you know you did not get the leaks directly from a state. Do you know that Russia didn't give you the leaks through an intermediary?
I'm not going to be playing 20 questions on our sources. I'm sure you understand, Alan, as a source protection organization, we're not going to be inscribing circles around who our sources are, how we communicate with them, any properties that might be used to arrest them or criticize them in some future process.
So it is possible that, as Comey said, Russia gave you the leaks through an intermediary.
I'm simply not going to comment on it.
Can you talk about what Julian was saying there and also what you know of the Mueller investigation investigating links between Trump associates and Russia's 2016, whether they were interfering with the U.S. elections and what WikiLeaks had to do with that?
Well, as Mr. Assange just said himself, WikiLeaks have made very clear that they didn't receive the information from a state source. Sourcing matters are a matter for WikiLeaks, and they're very careful about their sourcing and protecting their sources, which is why the organization continues to receive such important, sensitive public interest information. As to the Mueller investigation, our legal team for WikiLeaks has not been contacted by the investigation at all. There has been no information, at least that we've received, about any indication of any potential charges. And I think, again, it raises questions about sourcing and about the protection of publishers' ability to be able to publish. In our view, there's no connection between WikiLeaks and any kind of conspiracy. There's no evidence, even in the DNC suit that's been very publicly filed against WikiLeaks, that there's any indication of any prior arrangement or conspiracy, that WikiLeaks has received information from a source and published it, information that was shown to be in the public interest, which demonstrated corruption within the Democratic Party. This is important public interest information, and indeed the New York Times said that they would have published it had they received it. So again, we have to ask questions. Publishers have the right to receive and publish information in the public interest, and that is what WikiLeaks does. They should not be prosecuted for doing so.
Jen, how is Julian Assange in the embassy? He has been there for more than 6 years. It's a tiny embassy. And what is his condition?
He has been inside the embassy now for many years, and indeed over the past 6 months, he's been in there without access to the internet, phone calls or visitors. Just this week, he started to have visitors again, which is a good development. His health is deteriorating. This is something that we've been concerned about for a very long time. He doesn't have the ability to exercise outside. He doesn't have the ability to seek proper medical treatment, which we've been asking for many years. It's an incredibly difficult situation, and not anyone should be forced to be in this position. Now, of course, the confirmation that we've had today shows that his decision to seek asylum was the correct one, and Ecuador's decision to grant it to him was the correct one. Should a publisher be stuck inside a room for years on end because of a potential prosecution by the United States for publishing information in the public interest? And the answer is absolutely not. But he is, I think, in as good spirits as you can expect, but I'll wait to see him later this afternoon and have a discussion with him.
The Ecuadorian embassy cut off his access to internet, or does he have it now?
They have reinstored his ability to be able to have visitors. And in terms of the internet and other restrictions, there's a whole range of protocols that are in place. But at least the restrictions have been lifted in terms of visitors, and it's made a difference for him, certainly, in the past week.
Does Julian Assange feel he could walk outside? Does he think the British government, have they said they are going to arrest him if he does?
The British government have made very clear that if and when Julian walks outside of the embassy, he will be arrested to face potential prosecution for breach of bail and seeking asylum inside the embassy. We believe that he has a just excuse for having done so, having sought asylum, particularly in circumstances where we now have confirmation that the US has sought a sealed indictment. It remains to be seen whether there is an indictment and whether they will seek his extradition. And of course, as we heard from the confirmation overnight. We won't know that until he's in custody. But we very much expect that there will be an extradition request on the basis of this information. It's what we've been concerned about for a long time. So should he walk out, he will be arrested. He'll face bail proceedings and likely an extradition request as a result of what we've heard overnight.
Khalebi ki de gakhlena sonen geko te xamul kudul yow khalebi ndeyam banako bay ba banako te giso ci dara kharit nangal rekle kharit te nga xamni kuñ ko defon sa jigen dina la taxare
Garuko, Jesus, you know.